Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Back before the internet, before encyclopedias, before card catalogs, having a good memory wasn't just a useful thing. It was prized as a sign of intelligence. And there were memory geniuses, people who had developed complex mental techniques for storing information. Techniques like memory palaces, where you construct room after imaginary room and you fill them with memories. So that's the jumping-off point for philosopher Simon Critchley's new novel, Memory Theater. He told Steve Paulson that the idea for the story came partly from his own life. As a young man, he had a terrible accident, which erased a big chunk of his memory.
I was working in a pharmaceutical factory when I was 18 years old. I was cleaning out a machine that was mixing drugs for diabetics. And the fact that it was a pharmaceutical factory becomes important because it was sterile conditions. And you had to lean over into this machine, which was like a huge kind of like washing machine with steel paddles churning. And to get the last of the residue out of the bottom of the mixer, you had to get your hand inside the machine. As I was cleaning the bottom of this thing out, somebody turned on the machine. My hand was caught in the machine. And I managed to kind of extract it, but the thing was basically sort of hanging off. I kept the hand, which was really good news. Mm. But the effect of it was a kind of erasure of memory, which appeared in the ensuing weeks. I just realized that there was all sorts of things that had just been kind of scrubbed away.
Why would you have lost some of your memory?
Sometimes, you know, traumatic accident like that can lead to a kind of memory wipe. Sometimes it comes back, sometimes it doesn't. In my case, it was a series of loss of childhood memory. And then you've got this sort of, you know, peculiar kind of epistemological problem of you don't know, you know, much, and then you're told things by your family about who you are and, you know, what you did in the past. And you look at photographs and you think, well, that must have been me. And then you construct that memory as a memory that's yours, but you don't really remember it. You're not quite sure what it is that you know and you don't know.
So one of the big ideas of your book has to do with memory, and specifically
Yes. The
creation of what were called memory palaces, usually hundreds of years ago. And these were mental constructions where people would essentially place memories of all kinds of things, and they could be very elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I mean, there's an ancient Greek poet, a very, very famous and very rich Greek poet called Simonides. And there was a rather nasty story connected with Simonides, which was that he was giving a recitation for a lot of money with some wealthy people. And he stepped out of the building. The building collapsed and killed all the wealthy people inside. But he remembered where all the people were, so badly injured by the fall of the house on these people that they were unrecognizable. But Simonides was able to remember who was sitting where. And this began the idea that there was an association between memory and location and place. And that's the key of the idea of a memory palace or in the book I talk about a memory theater, the idea that memory is a location or a series of locations. And to have a trained memory is to basically be able to wander around inside your head and visit certain places where certain things are stored. And, you know, it raises this really interesting question that for most of human history, most of what was thought of as education was to have a rhetorically trained memory.
Right. I mean, the sign of intelligence was to have a great memory, right, for centuries.
And to be able to then produce that great memory in speech, you know, in order to persuade people of certain things or to recite things or whatever. And then there was a tradition which is in antiquity, but it really takes off in the Renaissance in Italy, where people actually constructed theatres, buildings that would house their memories. And
when you say construct, just construct in an imaginary way or actually physically construct?
Actually physically construct. I mean, there's evidence of maquettes being built and possibly more than that, so that a building, in this case a theatre, each of the seats in the theatre would be occupied by, let's say, a statue or a striking figure or, I don't know, the main characters in Homer's Iliad or whatever it might be. As you would survey your theatre, you would survey the entirety of what could be known and what you knew. and you'd be able to kind of enter and then recall everything.
Yeah. Well, there's a real historical figure who comes up prominently in your book, this Italian guy named Giulio Camillo. Tell me about him.
Well, he was he constructed memory theaters in Venice in the late 15th century. And the idea, this is a twist to the whole idea of the memory theater. You could build a memory theater that would house the entire sum of what could be known. And at the point of surveying the entirety of what could be known, at that point you would have absolute knowledge. You would have knowledge of the entirety of the sum of the universe.
You would basically be godlike at that point.
Exactly. At that point, the difference between you and God would disappear. You'd become, your intellect would have become divine. So you could see that was quite an attractive prospect for people. And so what you find in these memory theatres, memory palaces, are all sorts of kind of occult and hermetic interests.
Now, as you've already mentioned, there is an obvious modern analogy here. You know, these memory theatres would seem to be what Google is trying to do right now, to create
exactly.
a digital copy of everything that's ever been written so that it's accessible to everyone. I mean, in theory, at least, we could have the entire knowledge of the world at our fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Except we don't trust it anymore. We don't trust ourselves anymore. The strange thing is, and our difference with what's gone on in the past, is that memory was an internal activity. It was something you looked inward, you inspected your memory. It was something you had to recall internally. Whereas now we've gone to a model of kind of technologized memory, a kind of external memory. Everything is out there. Everything is potentially knowable in an objective archival form on the internet, and our heads are kind of empty.
And there's no particular currency to, or value to having a good memory now. I mean, yes, if you're in high school and you got to memorize a lot of stuff for a test, but other than that, I mean, you can get through life pretty well with having a lousy memory.
Yeah, and I think that's, whether that's a good or a bad thing in a sense, I'm not sure. I think it's a bad thing, but it makes us very different from most human creatures that have existed before, and most kind of forms of social organization where memory was highly treasured and highly prized and highly cultivated. Its veracity, are these memories true? In a sense, you know, it's neither here nor there. It's just these are the stories. So that a great poet, let's imagine a great bardic poet like Homer, would have been able to summon from memory the stories of the Trojan War. Would they have been empirically accurate? Well, it turns out, you know, actually a lot of it was, but the rest were kind of, there were stories, things that were told and passed on in an approximative form. And we risk losing access to that. And that worries me. Once you've memorized something, it's yours, you possess it. I think there's a kind of power to that, which is formidable. Those things that I remember were mine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, one final question. What happens to a society that loses its memories?
I think it ceases to be a society. I think it's in a very, very perilous state. And I think the strength of the social bond could be linked directly to the strength of memory, not as something, you know, that's stored on a series of hard drives or machines somewhere, you know, out in the desert, but something which is in people's heads and which connects them together. And of course, that can be illusory. You know, people can think all sorts of strange ideas about who they are as a people. But without a memory, I think a society just ceases to be a society. It becomes a kind of random amalgamation of individuals with no particular purpose.
Simon Critchley is a philosopher at the New School for Social Research. He and Steve were talking about his novel, Memory Theater.